join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and today, a bit of a crew chat, but also very special moment, because we're going to chat about Brad Trumbo's first book. It's your first book, right?
Yeah.
First book. We're going to talk about his first book. We're going to get into it. We're going to talk about some upland game bird recipes. We're going to talk about cooking upland game birds. We're going to talk about the whole shebang. So, first off, I'll do my due diligence and run through some stuff that we have going on, and I'll tell you about kind of what I'm doing. So, man, we've been on it now. This is probably week three or four that I've mentioned it, but I'm really trying to push it. So, we got a hunting camp coming up, right? I think I've coined it. I did some Google searches, and I haven't found any conflicts of interest yet. So, we're going to call it a field to fork hunting event. I don't know. It's a mouthful. I'll play around with it and get it solidified. But essentially, we're going to go down to Texas in April, the last weekend of April to be exact, and we're going to set up this really sweet lodge, and we're inviting you to come join us there, and we're going to teach you how to shoot, how to hunt, how to butcher, how to process, package, and then cook wild pig. It's going to be great. 3 days total, 4 nights at an awesome lodge. You get to spend time with me. You for sure get to spend time with Adam Berkelmans, who's going to be cooking. Adam Steele is going to be doing the butchering section. Ryan and or Emily Long will be there as well, teaching the shooting portion. Casey, our business manager, will be there. Corey may be there. Ben may be there. A whole bunch of people may be there. So if you like us and you enjoy hearing our voice and looking at our beautiful faces, although you're not looking at our beautiful faces on the podcast, but you listen to our beautiful voice, which is the same in person. I've listened to it both ways. I visited Corey in the spring, and he sounds just like he does on the podcast. Maybe quieter, though. But all good stuff, though. No, it's going to be a great weekend. It's good, so I don't care if you're someone who's been hunting for 20 years or somebody who just got their hunter safety card and are like, I'm ready to go, I want to learn how to do it. This course or this camp is intended to like give you everything you need that can translate over into other species. And one of the reasons we're doing it in Texas is because there's an invasive pig problem. We all know that. Second, it's very easy to host everyone at this really beautiful lodge and have the event space and the butcher space and the cooking space and all that stuff. So you're not really, when you look at it, the price of it, and I'll just go ahead and tell you, it's about $1,500, which is great. You're getting a Thursday night, a Friday night, and a Saturday night at this lodge. You're getting all your meals included. You're getting shooting instruction, hunting instruction, butchering instruction, storage instruction, and cooking instruction by literally some of the best minds in the community. I'll say that. Our folks are awesome. So you're not just paying to come out and shoot pigs. You're not just paying for land access. You're paying for literally the knowledge, the education, the experience. All of these things are packaged into one. So super awesome, super affordable when you compare it to a lot of other companies that are offering not as much. So really, really excited for it. So I invite you to come out, check it out. Link will be down in the show notes, or you can go, I think it's harvestingnature.com/hunting camps, I think, or maybe camps. Either way, we'll figure it out. But other than that, two spices. Spices should be rolling out here very soon. By the time you're hearing this, I think we're down to just a couple weeks. They're in production. They should be hitting the shipping phase. We're doing our big game blend first, followed up by our, I'm calling it Upland Fowl. You know how I learned something new in researching this, and Brad and Corey, feel free to chime in on this one. So waterfowl, right? All the waterfowl. On the opposite side, it's actually a term, landfowl. Have you guys ever heard that? I found that in a dictionary.
Are you talking for like upland birds? Terrestrial birds?
Yeah.
No, I've never heard of that.
So that makes total sense. I don't know. It, you know, it's obviously has fallen out of out of common language. But
I've just heard fowl. I've never heard fowl, but I've just heard fowl.
But now it makes sense. Waterfowl, right? Mm-hmm. We got waterfowl. And then, you know, we commonly say, like you said, Brad, upland game or upland fowl. But land fowl, I'm like, well, yeah, I guess it makes sense. So that'd be like turkey. It'd be all your non-waterfowl birds. So pretty
interesting.
Yeah. I toyed with calling the blend land fowl. And then I was like, I don't know. That may just like make some people uncomfortable. So I just stuck with upland fowl blend. But that blend's going to cover all your bases for everything from like your darker colored meats to like your lighter colored meats in the fowl world of the land. We'll put out another waterfowl blend in the winter of 2022/23. So excited about that. As far as for me, the updates I have, we're literally at the tail end of the season in Colorado. So we've got like small games left till the end of February. So I think I'm going to try to make it out this weekend for some squirrels and rabbits and whatnot. And then beaver goes until April. So I think those will kind of be on my radar. But I'm starting to plan all my fall hunts and my late spring hunts. Excited about that. Should be some cool things going on. Corey, what you got?
Well, so the last podcast I spoke about the Freedom Hunters, our pheasant hunt, and we had it, and the weather could not have been worse. It was, I don't know, about 18 degrees, 30 mile an hour winds, snow, single digit wind chill. It was pretty cold, but that didn't deter the hunters. So we had 21 coming, but three couldn't make it because of the conditions, driving conditions. They couldn't make it.
But I can attest to the Pennsylvania driving conditions in the winter. Terrible.
So we had 150 pheasants and 11 chucker. Three of the pheasants were melanistic, so they're like a color phase. They were a real deep purple instead of like that coppery orange color. So what we did, so we split the hunters into three groups. And we put one of those birds in each, and those three groups hunt three specific regions. So we keep the three groups away from each other, so, you know, safety reasons and whatnot. But in each one of the hunt zones, we put one of these melanistic birds. And we had Lake Erie Taxidermy donate one free mount to the hunt. And I was trying to figure out the best way to give that free taxidermy away. And I thought, that what if whoever gets one of those melanistic birds puts their name into a hat and we draw from that hat and that's who gets the mount? Well, it happened that only one person got one of those birds, so he automatically won the free mount. So we had Eric McCracken get one of those, and he was pretty happy about it. So, but despite the weather, we had a good time and had a lot of fun and killed a few birds. So it was a good time.
It looked, I will tell you, I saw the news clip from your local news station. That guy was very bold to come out and cover that story.
Yeah. we were out in the field, and I'm not sure who told him to drive, but he drove up this access road. It's, mind you, there's snow on the ground, and they're in this, I don't know what kind of vehicle. It was like a little Kia or something. They drove up into the field, way out into the middle of the where we were hunting, and then all of a sudden I see this guy with the camera standing out in the middle of the field, you know, in this blizzard, and I'm like, who is that? then realized it was the newscaster. So he was, they took their job seriously. They got out there and got into the thick of it.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. It was really good on you guys for putting that on despite those conditions, but also for, you know, like you're saying, for the newscasters to get out there and actually cover it in that kind of condition.
Yeah, it was good.
And that weather, because in the clip too, you can see like the visibility, like they're across the field, and you're like, there's like three hunters over there. If I squint, I can see them through the snow.
Yeah, the snow was blowing horizontal, so it was blowing hard, and like when those birds got up, if you didn't get them, they were gone. Like they were moving. They were just flying right with that wind, and you just had a few seconds. It calmed down a little bit as the day went on, but especially in the morning there, it was pretty nasty.
That's wild, man. Yeah, that's cool. It's cool though. We've talked about it. What, we've had a couple episodes where you discussed. We had one where you discussed the hunt, and then we had another one where we had what's the gentleman's name?
Yeah, Anthony Pace.
Anthony Pace on. Yeah, great stuff. Great organization. We'll throw those in the show notes, so if you want to go back and list those, don't mind the audio quality. It was the early days of the podcast, and we were still getting our feet under us. But still, the content's just as awesome as ever. But, yeah, all right. Well, you got anything else going on? Any hunting seasons or fishing seasons?
Our small game like yours ends this weekend, but I probably won't make it out. It's supposed to be crappy like that again this weekend, so I don't think I could do it two weekends in a row. Here coming in March, our trout fishing season opens up the first part of April, but all through March the Pennsylvania Fish Commission stocks the local streams, so it's a a yearly tradition. I take the take the kids out of school.
Oh yeah.
And we help stock a stream. So we're doing that. Nice. Make a day out of it, big group of friends and go to breakfast and then help stock, and so I'm looking forward to that.
It does sound like fun.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that'll be a good day.
When is turkey season there?
It typically starts like the last weekend of April or the first weekend of May, somewhere around there. Pennsylvania starts a lot later than most states, and that's by design because the Game Commission wants the gobblers to breed, as many hens as possible, and continue to populate the turkeys, and so our season starts pretty late compared to everybody else.
Nice. All right. Well, I'll put it on my calendar. I said, I'm starting to work on my hunts. I still got that spring turkey tag.
You do, yeah. You got to fill something in PA.
Yeah. Other than my beer mug.
I mean, there are worse problems to have with that, right?
Right? All right, Brad. You want to give everybody a quick reminder of who you are and what you do?
Yep, so I'm Brad Trumbo. A lot of you know me as Tail Feathers Upland on Instagram. I'm an author and a fish and wildlife biologist and enamored with all things upland birds. So just about everything you see from me has to do with upland bird hunting, hence one of the reasons I'm on the podcast today. As far as hunting seasons go for us, we're looking at, I think we have hare and cottontail open until middle of March. And I swore to myself I was going to make a concerted effort to try to find a cottontail or two. I know a couple of good sites, and after this past super cold snap and some snow, I'll probably be throwing on some snowshoes here before the 15th and trying to hike up high and find a hare. I know some places where I've cut tracks in the past when I've been in there hunting mule deer in the snow, so we'll have to go take a look and see what happens on that.
I think I need to invest in some snowshoes. I got to figure that out. I haven't done it yet.
I would recommend it. I got them just kind of on a whim, probably right I guess the first fall we were under lockdown for COVID, and we started to actually get some snow around here in the winter, right? So it's like, yeah, I'm going to try some snowshoeing for some fun in the early part of the calendar year. But then after hunting a valley quail with the snowshoes here in early January, I was like, hey, this is actually a heck of a lot of fun. We're going to have to do this as often as possible now, so I would recommend it.
Surprisingly, I was just looking at them. They're not as expensive as I thought they would be. I'm guessing some could be like super expensive, but like that's pretty reasonable. I bet you too. I could find some used ones. It's a good takeaway for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I got mine from like Sportsman's Warehouse or something. They were something big enough to fit a 300-pound dude, and they were very reasonably priced.
That reminds me, I read in your book, are you 6'7"?
I am. I'm just a smidge smaller than Sasquatch. So.
Oh, nice. I'm not going to make any tall jokes, but I mean, I'm 6'1", but that's like, that's awesome.
Some days.
I was reading where you're talking about going to, I think it's North Dakota when you guys were goose hunting. Mm-hmm. And you had your black cap was poking up out of the goose blind.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that I wrecked that whole hunt. There were there were too many geese flying around, you know, and we were in just fresh cut corn stubble and had a good spread. And I swear it's because my head was sticking out of the layout blind.
I talk about this, and like if fish were any smarter, we'd never be able to catch them. And I'm starting to learn, like geese are like so weary of like anything. It's just like plus they're like, we can land anywhere. We'll land on baseball fields. We'll land, you know, at your golf courses. We'll just take over everything. But that cornfield, there's some weird lumps out there. We're not landing in that.
Right. Yep, they're like that brown trout who's really slick on which, you know, what's a fly and what's not, you know. What if one little teeny thing out of place and they're just going to avoid it.
Yeah, man. So, I'll tell you. Okay. I'll let everybody know. We're here obviously to talk about Brad's book, Wing Shooting Over the Palouse. Palouse, I said it right?
Palouse.
Palouse. I even asked you. Is it what's the origin of that word? Is it French?
That's a really good question. I actually haven't looked into the origin of it, but the Palouse is basically a region of eastern Washington and northwestern Idaho that's just incredibly fertile here, kind of on the Columbia Plateau, and so it grows small grains extremely well, and there are hundreds of thousands of acres of wheat and lentils and green peas and chickpeas and whatever else spread out across this whole area, kind of north and south of the Snake River in this general area.
So have you been to eastern Colorado to hunt yet?
Not to hunt yet, no.
All right. Well, the invitation's there. You let me know when you're ready.
Sounds good.
Because I'll tell you that, like, after reading your book, I'm so pumped for, like, bird season. I came out here, and, like, traditionally I have not been a big upland game hunter, bird hunter, upland bird hunter. I've shot rabbits and other crawling mammals, but never as many birds other than like dove, maybe a few quail here and there. But I now put it on my list as moving out to Colorado, especially eastern Colorado. Like, I've got to hit some of these. I'm out west. There's plenty of public land. There's plenty of opportunity to get out and harvest a variety of different species. But then I read your book, which I wrapped up today, like I told you, and I'm just like, man, oh man, now I'm pumped. Like,
well, yeah. So, you know, the going right into it, that first chapter talks about how having my own upland bird dog and actually living in a place that had a variety of bird species just really totally pulled me away from being an avid big game hunter. And now, like, upland birds are on my mind 24/7 and just wanting to run the dogs and just go through that whole enactment.
So what are you doing now in the off season to kind of prep?
Well, so the off season has been a little lax for me in the past, partially because I never really had a lot of training tools or a lot of time. My wife and I both have side businesses, and you know we spread ourselves pretty thin. And I put a lot of effort into Pheasants Forever in the off season. But that said, this past winter I finished up pigeon coop, and I've got a bunch of homing pigeons. And as soon as they lay a clutch this spring, I'm going to start using those birds for training, and mostly just to, well, okay. So I've got one dog, and I talk about her quite a bit in the book. Her name's Zeta, mm-hmm. and she's a 4-year-old little squirt, and who really needs some practice on steady to wing. She needs to hunt every day as a team, not just when she's tired of running for herself and then decides to hunt with me, right? So that's a struggle that we have every single day. But that's going to be my off season, is going to be working these dogs on pigeons. And I might get a couple of other pen raised game birds here and there. But mostly I like the pigeons because, you know, you use them over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And really just getting the dog, that dog in particular, to hold steady to the flush is what I'm really after. So that's going to be my spring and summer this year.
So let me ask you, do you like skeet shooting or any kind of like prep to kind of stay, to keep the edge?
I don't shoot a lot, and I don't claim to be a good shot. And honestly, it's okay with me because sometimes I feel like if I actually hit and killed as many birds as I shoot at, it might be problematic for the bird population in Southeast Washington. So, you know, I really don't mind missing birds. When I get just those perfect crossing shots or whatever, or a pheasant or something sits really tight for the dog, and I get that textbook flush and drop a bird or something, then absolutely perfect. I put enough in the freezer to make us all happy in a season. Also, one of the reasons I haven't done a lot of shooting the past couple of years in particular is because of the ammo shortage. You know, for pheasants forever, we've been playing a really hard time just getting flats of target loads for our skeet circuits and whatnot that we do for youth. So I've been really conservative on that.
Oh, yeah. I could imagine, too. I didn't even think about that. And I've squirreled away, you know, target loads and some lead shots and stuff, just like I gotta have them in case I want to go out to go hunt. But man, yeah, the ammo shortage. I'm hoping to see the end.
Yeah, no joke.
So can you give just a real quick, not as detailed as you want, an overview kind of the book for those out there?
Sure. So Wing Shooting the Palouse is really a collection of different essays over the past decade or so that I've experienced. And it really, the purpose of it is to wrap in the holistic experience of hunting upland birds, you know. So and this is a hard thing for me to explain, because if it weren't for the upland birds and wanting to go out and hunt those birds, what would be the point, right? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have my dogs. I wouldn't go out and I wouldn't hunt birds. So that hunting the actual birds and, you know, carrying a shotgun with the intent to shoot birds is the foundation of the hunt. But when you actually get out there and orchestrate that hunt, that just becomes a facet of it. There is so much involved in the hunt, and, you know, the teamwork between the hunter and the canine, and the landscape. You know, I talk about cultural history in here and in a particularly interesting area to me in the Scablands of Central Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And just the overall beauty of the grasslands. And it's so many things just all come together, particularly for upland hunting for me. And I write about these experiences because everybody sees the hunt through a different lens, and everybody kind of has a different take home. And for me, at the end of the day, the take home is having gone and hunted public land or public access, you know, with my dogs, having had a good time, because there's never a bad day in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we get lucky, and we pretty much always find birds. Getting lucky is I get the shot that I need, and I connect with a bird, and, you know, I bring a bird or two home here and there. But really, it's just a matter of all of the beautiful things about the outdoors and public land and working with the dogs and seeing the birds and the landscape, all of those things I really try to wrap in, because that the entire orchestration of a hunt is what inspires me to go do it. It's not a body count at the end of the day or something like that, you know. So there's just so much more to be gained from upland hunting than something like that.
No, that's awesome. Well said. I definitely recommend it to anybody who, it doesn't matter if you're into hunting upland birds or if you are just interested or it's all completely new to you. Like, I think it's a good all-around, like, here's some awesome stories, get you pumped, you get kind of inside Brad's head, you see, like, how much he loves his fur babies, because that is very apparent throughout the entire book, is, like, how much love you show them, which is pretty cool.
Hey, what, Brad, what do you think your favorite story or essay from the book is?
Oh, man. That's a really tough one. Because so many of them were so much fun to write. But I'll have to give a shout out to Jorge Ramirez for Hip Like Jorge, the Upland parody. And because it's so, that's such an unusual piece for me. You know, it's literally a mockery of upland hunting. And Jorge inspired it with an April Fool's writing that he did a few years ago. When I read it, I died. I died laughing. It was one of those things where nobody's safe, while it's literally just meant to be fun, I had to write something similar. And so I ended up doing it, thinking about Jorge, and he and I have a good relationship through social media and whatnot. And he's a super talented artist. So I've got a couple of his works here for the deer room. One of these days, well, I guess it's a bird room now. One of these days when I get this place remodeled, those are going to be up on the wall and just kind of stacking.
Is that
them up
the, he does the guy Taku of the birds,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yep. So I've got a few of those. Yep. And he's at what? Upland Art and Upland Jitsu. Those are his two handles on Instagram. So anyway, that just for funsies, that was probably one of my favorites.
I did like that one a lot. And you talk about you're meeting him and like, and then at the end, it cracked me up. Cause then at the end you're like, yeah, I just tossed my pipe out the window. I'm just like, oh man,
all the
stereotypes.
it was so much fun to be had there with that one. But I just have to say that, all of the good things I said about Jorge were truthful. They were intended to be good things, I think he is super suave and he's a nice guy and whatnot. But I had to poke at some of the things that he had said and what he had written, So I let him review that one before I published it. I was like, no way do I want to offend this guy. Luckily, he enjoyed it, and he let me use some of his art for that chapter, which that particular piece of art inspired the ending to the story, too. So all around a lot of fun. Shout out to Jorge. He's a good guy.
You do mention social media several times kind of in the book, and I guess how has social media shaped you as a hunter? Because the way I look at it is bird hunting is something that can be done, especially if you have your own dogs. Like, you can be very solo in that, but there's also a huge community aspect to bird hunting that's what attracts a lot of people, is like, we can all line up, we can march through the field, and shoot birds and have a good time, come back and, enjoy a beverage and have some laughs. But how has social media played into your growth as a hunter?
Social media has played into that a number of different ways. I think for starters, it's some of the photography that you get to see and the stories that folks are telling are truly inspirational on their own. And going a little further than that, upland hunting is a very traditional type of hunt. I talk in one of the chapters about the tradition of carrying classic firearms, and I'm one of these guys who gets suckered right into the nostalgia type things, right? So my latest double gun edition was a 1911 LC Smith that is the smoothest, probably one of the sweetest side-by-sides I'll ever own. And I have no idea what the backstory is on it, and I really wish I did. But, that gun's over a century old, and what it could tell me if it could talk and how it feels to carry that gun.
I tell you the... Sorry... to kind of the LC Smiths. So I have two that I inherited from my grandfather. One is the 12 gauge that was made in 1886, and the other one is a 16 gauge that was made in the 1890s. And I've never fired either. They're side by side. They're hammerless. They are the most beautiful articulate guns I've ever seen. And as I was reading in the LC Smith, you're right, nostalgia. I was just like, oh man, it takes me back. It's like, I remember when he bought them at an auction at an estate sale, and he was so proud of, like, look at this gun. He was also a little pissed because somebody outbid him and he had to bid higher than he wanted to get it, but he got it.
Nice.
So, but I remember, like, and even after he passed away, he was just like kind of taking it out of the gun case and just holding it and looking at it and just being like, man, this is such a cool gun. And exactly the thing you mentioned is like, what is the backstory to this gun? Because the one, 1886, that gun's 100 years older than me. So, man, what did it see in those 100 years?
Right. Yeah. And you know, the tradition goes far deeper too. Like, there was the story of the wooden dove migration, where Charlie Jordan, you know, kind of spurs this thing every year to basically raise awareness for the wooden decoy and hand carving tradition type things. And I got on board with that and learned quite a bit from, you know, just having the interest sparked and looking into some of the history of decoys and being able to shoot doves over some decoys that, you know, somebody cut and carved and passed along for that particular purpose. And so there's just an awful lot of tradition, and I guess that kind of brings an overall sense of community from my perspective, you know, being able to interact with folks through social media in that regard. I've got another story in here that was another one that was really fun, Pheasant Firearms and Internet Strangers. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Yep,
That hunt with Darren McCall was absolutely just freaking awesome, and I'm looking forward to getting out with him again soon. You know, if somebody had met through social media and was like, hey, let's go hunt some birds, and man, that guy pulled the stops out. Like, the places he took me to hunt. It's like, well, Darren, if you come hunt with me, I can't promise that many birds. You know, it looks quite like that. But
it's, I think it too. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation going on right now as far as, like, social media's role in the hunting community and whether or not social media wants to be there. And, you know, we've got places like Go Wild that are specifically catered towards individuals who want to talk about their outdoor activities in sort of like a quote unquote safe space. But man, I think first off, I would never be doing what I'm doing without social media. And I remember like the time the table turned. And just like you had the blog era, you had the Facebook era, you had the Instagram era, and then you had kind of this all-encompassing of like, we have to use every piece of social media to connect with everybody we can because you never know what somebody's attracted to. And it's allowed me to connect with so many people, and I mean, including you two. Like, I never would have met either one of you if it wasn't for some form of social media. Like, Harvesting Nature wouldn't be what it is today without it. But I recognize the points people bring up and I don't always agree with it. I'm not going to use this podcast as a platform to like express my concerns because we're here to talk about your awesome work. But I think it's great to be on the same page with that. Of like, I think within the hunting community, using it for the point of like connecting with folks and like, hey, here's the awesome things kind of going on and like, oh, do you want to go hunt? Do you want to go fish? Do you want to go forage? Do you want to go do these things? Like connecting with people of like minds, like that's 100% the intent, at least the original intent. So, right. Awesome. I just wanted to ask that question because you did mention it sometime there and I had Jorge's, little story written down here because I wanted to talk about him too because I followed him on Instagram and even the Upland art, I think it's so cool. And then thinking about the wooden dove migration, I've seen so many people buy into it. I think this year may be my year that I'm gonna sign up and give it a go. But not to mention, Brad, you have some really awesome photography and I get to see your photography on social media, which is good. And I wanted to ask you too, like, how do you create that balance when you're out hunting of like the photography and the hunting? Because I've struggled with it.
So how is a really difficult question. Poorly is what I like to say, because for me, it's a choice. You know, do I worry about handling and shooting or the gun, mm-hmm. or do I worry about working the camera? And I have to admit that this past season, I left my SLR at home or in the truck more often, because I felt like I wasn't necessarily doing the dogs a disservice. My dogs don't care. They're used to me not hitting birds, right? So they don't care if they're happy to run and they're happy to find birds, and they do their thing really well, and we all have a great time. But I made it more of a point to, I guess, pay more attention to working with those dogs and just orchestrating the hunt for what it is, right? And so I carried the iPhone, and I took some iPhone photos, which are always – they always get me about three-quarters of what I would like to see in some of the stuff that I do. Mostly the detailed photos I can do, and I'm pretty satisfied with the iPhone. But if I'm really looking for photography and I'm being serious about it in a hunt, my shooting is going to suffer. And sometimes I'm not gonna give the dog the kind of attention they need, and that's really what it comes down to. Like, there's one of the stories I wrote in there, and I can't remember which one particularly, but I think it's Better Lucky Than Good. I talk about my oldest dog Finn finding the needle in the haystack partridge covey that I had just tripped on years ago while I was deer hunting, and was like, we're going to go find those birds. And sure enough, that covey was almost identically where I had seen them years ago. And that dog found them. And I did the very risky move of, I'm going to try to get a photo of this dog on point here before I go flush. And somehow or another, I got the photo and I got a bird.
Yeah.
Yes. That was one of those rare moments, but it was like, I knew how touchy that was, you know, with partridge. And the covey birds always like to run. I mean, basically in my experience, all of them run. Every one mm-hmm. of them runs. You know, roosters are the worst, but the partridge and all the covey birds just start to scuttle along. And I knew that I had taken long enough by the time I got to that dog, just so I could get the one photo of her on point, that the birds were moving because her demeanor was starting to change. Luckily, you know, all of it just somehow miraculously came together, and the birds were still within gun range when they came up. But that's, you know, that's the trade-off.
Yeah, I think I'm it's hard too, and I've looked at it. Now that I got a little more into filming and photography and stuff, and like, how do you, it's such a like on off switch. There's no like, I can't do the camera in one hand and my rifle in the other, my binos in the other. I'm like, I'm one other place. Like last year we were out spring bear hunting, and I was like taking a picture of Ben. Like, this is the best picturesque. We're on the side of this clear cut. We're looking down on this bottom. The sun's setting. He's like got his hoodie on. He's like, nobody ever really takes pictures of me. I was like, dude, don't worry. I got you. I broke out my DSLR. And I was like, boom. And then Ben's like, bear, bear, bear. And I was like, ah. And then it just all erupted.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
right.
And then the camera got put away, and I think we went down for the bear, and I just got left behind. And we filmed everything else on the phone.
Yep, understood. Like, I got a piece of public land that gets hunted really hard, and it's a prime piece down on the Snake River. And I've never actually killed a pheasant in there, but I don't know how many I've shot at. And I was there with some buddies last fall. I can't remember if it was 21 or 20, but a handful of us went and hunted it. And there were like 30 some birds that got up way, way ahead of us. They were just, you know, running around us, running long, blowing up wild, way, way out of range. And my buddies took their dogs and peeled out. And I went to the other side of this property, and I hadn't gone 100 yards from the parking lot, and the dog started working a bird. And I was like, what do you know? That thing's probably moved on. And so I've got the camera, and it's one of those moments where the sun is just streaming through her tail feathers. She's on point, and I've got this wheatgrass and this, you know, the basalt bluffs in the background. And as I'm snapping a photo, my eye catches a rooster come into the frame, and I'm like, you gotta be, you know? So I get the photo, I'm like, well, there's a candid for you. I literally drop the camera. I've got the gun, and I don't know what hand. By the time I got the gun up and got it shouldered, swung through, totally missed the bird twice, and the dog is just like, what in the hell are you doing? she circles back and is like, why don't we just go home?
Yeah. It's like, take me to the truck, I'm done.
Right.
Oh man, yeah, it's such an interesting thing. So we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but for those who are not familiar with kind of bird hunting or field hunting, what's the kind of process like? If you walked me through, like, all right, we get there, we park, like, we talk about what we're gonna do, we unload the dogs, we kind of prep, like, what's that kind of look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so this is something that's different in different geography. And so by that, I mean where I hunt a lot south of the Snake River in this little southeast corner of Washington, we have a lot of very small parcels. You know, so when I and I'll put this in the context for you. When I talk about where I hunt in places like Montana, literally the small, if I'm looking at what I would call a small piece of geography in Montana, you've got 100,000 acres of BLM. That doesn't include the state parcels or the block management parcels or whatever else in this particular area. Where I'm at, you know, my typical hunts are a couple hundred acres. And it's one of those places you got to be real careful about with the number of hunters that also hunt there, you know, not just myself. And where you can actually access the properties relative to what's the wind like for the day or, you know, other environmental conditions. So with that kind of a caveat and context there, if I'm hunting on the Palouse, I've got a spot or two, let's say any given parcel where I can access that thing. And it's just the typical setup is, you know, pull the truck over, get it parked. I don't keep my dogs collared up and ready to go. I keep them just in their regular leash collar. So I get the truck stopped. I break out a Garmin unit, power it up, and I get myself geared up. I get my gun out. I get my vest on. I get everything set up. The last thing I do is put the GPS collar on that dog. And then I'll pull out, whether it's one or two. I carry two collars. I don't run more than two dogs at a time, partially because it gives me an opportunity to hunt longer throughout the day, and I don't push my dogs too hard because I've got freaking four of them right now, right? So grab a dog or two and take them over to where we're going to begin. I like to try to work any cover into the wind because it gives the dog the advantage. You can't always do that. No big deal. You know, you get out, the dog's going to freak out for a couple of seconds. I end up calling them back in, and I set them down. And if I've got anybody else hunting with me, particularly if it's someone who's not used to hunting with dogs, which I actually, for the first time ever, I hunted with a guy this past fall who'd never hunted behind a bird dog. And he had always hunted grouse on foot, you know, by himself in New England. And I was like, you're in for a treat today, man. We're going to hunt partridge, and we're going to find birds, and you're going to see a bird dog work, right? So I tell them what to expect with the dog, like what it means when they're doing things. But anyway, got the dog there. And then if they're leashed or whatever, I just have them by the collar, unclip them, and I'm just like, go find them. And the dog knows what to do, you know. The dog leaves, and I just start walking. I'll throw a couple of shells in the gun. And and honestly, I don't pay a lot of attention to the dog when they're running. They generally check in with me, so I just kind of keep an eye on the general direction they're moving, and just go for a stroll. And it, you know, having the GPS unit takes so much. I don't want to say it takes attention away from the dog or off of the dog, but it takes a lot of questioning off. You know, it takes a lot of the pressure off, a lot of where might that dog be. The first few years that I hunted, probably the first 6 years, I think, I didn't run any collars on any electronics on my dogs. Didn't train them with e-collars, didn't run GPS. When I got my youngest, For our North Dakota trip, I ended up getting GPS units because that dog is a whole different beast. And I wasn't going to drop her without them. I never would have gotten her back. So, you know, the days of, well, I haven't heard or seen that dog in a while. It must be on point somewhere. Where the hell is it? Those days are gone. So I just walk along and I like it when I can pay attention to the dog. And they usually work within 100 to 200 yards now. The older dogs are starting to slow down, and they hunt closer, and they check in a lot. So I love to keep an eye on the dog because I'm really there to watch the dog work and to be a part of the hunt with the dog. And I just follow them. I let them tell me where to go. If we end up working a smaller parcel, you know, sometimes I'll kind of guide them one way or another to make sure we cover it in an advantageous fashion. Otherwise, you know, if they're out of sight, I don't even sweat it because I know they're going to check in. Or if the handheld unit beeps, I know the dog's on point and they're going to stand right there until I get there. Even with the young dog, she'll hold point now. It's just a matter
That's
of
so cool.
Yeah, it's just a matter of, is she 50 yards or 500 yards, you know? So, yeah. But that's really what it is. I take a walk with a dog. I follow the dog and just have a ball with them, and we just go out there and have fun and take in the scenery and see some good dog work and put up some birds here and there. And you know, every new site, I mean, I got enough sites that I know well enough that I know what to expect for each one. I know about where we're going to find birds or if there are different, you know, changes in cover types, what it's going to mean for birds and mm-hmm. how likely they are to be there. But if it's somewhere we've never been, no problem. Put the dog out and just follow them.
So that does having an older dog that is better trained or more experienced help with the younger dog learn more quickly?
In my experience, yes. My oldest, I hunted her with my second dog and then my youngest dog to help me with the training because, you know, I'll be the first person to say I'm not a great dog trainer and I've never really had the good tools for it until now. For my middle pup, Yuba, my older dog Finn was an incredible mentor, but some of that depends on the dog. So Yuba was just born with a prey drive and a tenacity that everybody loves to see in a hunting dog. It's something you just can't teach. And she is my number one pheasant dog. She doesn't put as many birds in the bag because she is so just amped to hunt that she, you know, she's not as, I guess she's just not as steady as my older dog. Sometimes she'll run past birds or she'll get excited and, you know, one thing or another. But that dog knows how to find pheasant. And when it comes to a running bird, she knows how to stop them. And so, you know, that's something you can't teach a dog. They have to learn it on their own. She, as far as what pheasant were and what really lit the spark with her, had it not been for my older dog, you know, when Yuba was a puppy, hunting with her and us getting some birds and whatnot, those first few hunts and Yuba's first years hunting with the older mentor dog were really crucial. So I think it's awesome. I have to say that with Zeta, my youngest, who's still the wild card, the first couple of birds I shot over that dog where she was actually on point, holding point, she was almost shoulder to shoulder with my older dog, Finn. And so it definitely, having Finn in the field has helped Zeta hold point longer. You know, so mm-hmm. yeah, I would say it definitely helps. Zeta's still just Zeta. There's no other way to talk about that dog other than she should probably be a good field trialer and not trying to hunt with me.
I was going to ask, so this is a 2-part question, favorite bird to hunt and favorite bird to eat, because we have to talk about food.
Okay. Yeah, to. No, that's actually a really good. Really good question. You know, up until a few years ago, I would have said pheasant just because that was what I pursued the most.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I have to say, after the past couple of seasons of having some spectacular Hungarian partridge numbers on the Palouse, partridge are without a doubt my favorite birds to hunt. And I think it's just that total combination of the short grass habitats that they thrive in, and what it feels like and what it looks like and what it sounds like when a covey rises, and how they challenge the dog to work them, because, you know, huns move quite a bit, and they're similar to chukar in that you can kind of see some of their sign as you're getting closer to a covey. You can start, you know, seeing the fresh sign, and you start seeing your dog is getting birdy and whatnot, and then they run a little bit. But a dog that's hunted them a few times can learn how to get around them and stop them. And when they do that, and the dog is just, you know, the dog gets that look in its eye, and you're like, oh yeah, there's a covey here. And especially when you're seeing, you know, 20 plus birds get up, and it's a, you know, a good covey, and you want to shoot at them, man, that is just spectacular. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds awesome. You painted that picture very well. Now let's turn to the table. So
I learned a good lesson this past fall, and I'm going to have to say it's chukar.
Okay.
I'll say that I never in my life dreamed that chukar would be my favorite upland bird, but that's because I just never killed any. I've been hunting them for years. I finally got into some chukar this past fall, and I was absolutely shocked at how tasty those birds were, you know. I think one of my favorite pheasant recipes was published in the Outdoor News this past fall, and I thought it just couldn't get better than that until I took a handful of chukar and did them in the sous vide, and then did a glaze. Ooh. It was this strange glaze that I had gotten an idea for, and I'm not going to talk too much about it because I'm going to pitch it to you guys later for your cookbook.
Yes.
But it was something that was just like, it's really unique. If I could liken the glaze to anything, I would call it like a leathery bourbon kind of a whiskey drink. Something that
I
just,
like it. I'm intrigued for sure.
It's intriguing. Now, it doesn't sound very appetizing, but man, that thing, when you try it on some chukar that have been sous vide and then seared, holy smokes. So yeah, that was definitely as good as it gets.
That's good. Yeah, I'm trying to think, probably one of my favorites. And like I said, I don't have much experience, so I don't have the portfolio, but quail are good. I like quail, and obviously dove, as long as we're not talking about dove poppers, but I'll save that for another day. I dug up, actually, so before we hopped on here, I dug up a couple of your recipes, which I can mention real quick. So your pheasant Thai curry.
That one's spectacular.
Oh, yeah. I love a good curry, too, and it's just like, man, it does look phenomenal. I think with bell pepper. You okay, Corey? Okay. This guy, don't die. You're not allowed to die while we're recording. So this recipe, very bell peppers, peanut butter. You've got milk in there, Thai curry sauce, over noodles too, which is really, really good. Man, it does look, Thai noodles too, so like those fat rice noodles, which I really like. It does look great. Good use, and you're using like the pheasant breast for that, probably. Okay. And then I know you like to sous vide, and this one's a favorite too. Sous vide pepper sage quail. That's a good one too. Man, quail are just so tasty. And that one, the sous vide. So I like it because a lot of folks have really caught on, and you know, you and I being one of those folks as well. But like the sous viding of game birds, like, does so much to not dry them out, which I think that's one of the big, big points when you're looking at cooking game birds, because they dry out so, so easy that I'll recommend to folks out there that if you're looking for a good way to like, to do, definitely not a traditional cook, but to do a good a cook method you should take as a habit. The sous vide to sear, and then, you know, like Brad just mentioned, adding the sauce or doing something else. Like, it's a phenomenal way to do the birds. I think you can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, and that's really a game changer for folks who want to try it. Mm-hmm. You really can't screw something up in the sous vide. You know, no. There's no possible way to overcook it. So,
I've screwed something up in the sous vide. It's possible.
No way.
Oh, no. Everyone except for Corey, you're okay.
I did a venison. Oh, it was like a top round or something like that, boneless top round. And I sous vide had it for like 24 hours, and it turned to mush. Like, the texture was just gross.
Okay, so that's a good point you bring up. The longer you do it, the softer it gets. So yeah, if you do something that long, it would be a pâté, basically.
Yeah.
What you should have done. Make a smoothie out of it and just go on. Terrible.
I was so heartbroken when I pushed that into the garbage can, but I was like, there's no possible way I can eat that.
You know what? I got an idea. I have an idea. This may be revolutionary. For overcooked sous vide meat, dehydrator for jerky.
Never crossed my mind.
Yeah, but I mean, think about it. You do the little the jerky gun, right? And it's just like ground meat that's essentially like pulverized. So if you overcook your meat, I'll say it here first on the the Wild Fishing Game podcast. If you overcook your meat in a sous vide, put it in the dehydrator and send me an email and tell me how it comes out. Like, slice it first.
Harvesting Nature Test Kitchen.
There it is.
There you go. I think the longest I've left birds in might have been 6 hours, and those would have been chucker. Usually, I'll do venison up to 6 hours pretty regular, but usually three to four is about where I stop with most things.
I had it was a 3 or 4 pound bison roast that I did for like, what did I do it for? 36 hours. But that thing, oh my gosh, it turned out phenomenal. But that was a huge chunk of meat. Yeah, yeah. Obviously something smaller. And I think, too, you can go on. There are some good resources. Maybe that's what we should do. We need to put together a game bird sous vide guide with all the different cooking times and weights. But there are some good resources, like use off chicken poundage and other things like that out there. So.
And something good maybe for the listener to know, if you're not familiar with sous vide, it's a warm water bath, and when you put your meat in there, you put it in a sealed bag, like a silicon bag, or
Ziploc, vac seal, anything. Yeah.
You cook it in its own juice. You know, You will ruin your food if you put it in there. Just drop it in the water. Just saying. You know.
You're just boiling it.
Basically, yeah. And so, you know, that's not something obvious to folks if they don't really have a grasp of what sous vide means. So, just wanted to put that out there.
We actually have an episode, a whole entire episode on sous vide wild game, right, Corey? It's way back in the dictionary.
Yeah,
we'll put it in the show notes. You can listen to it. let's see. What was I going to say? I think those are kind of like the really good recipes. I think that we've hit on. There's a multitude of other recipes on the website for Upland Game, but those are Brad's, which I wanted to talk about because he's here. But other than that, I think really. I really, really recommend this book. Got me pumped. I'm ready now. I'm on the verge of getting a dog. I'm not going to do it.
Come on.
You just got a dog.
Sore subject, Corey. I'll tell you later. So, yeah, not a bird dog, but definitely makes me think about it. And also, too, Definitely very, very interested to get more into it. So I would recommend anybody pick up the book. Brad, where can they get the book?
Yeah, right now it's available on Amazon. So nice. Just search up Wing Shooting the Palouse. It'll come up. It's also available at Keoki Books. That's K-E-E-O-K-E. They are based out of Sandpoint, Idaho. They're a publisher and marketer that I worked with to get this book published and get it out there for folks.
Sweet. Also, too, we'll put a link down in the show notes so you can click on that as well, and then we'll throw some links up on the website, obviously, because we want to support our fellow Harvest in Nature crew in their endeavors.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, and I appreciate being able to write with you guys and do podcasts and whatnot. This is an excellent group, and I think the content provided from Harvesting Nature to the consumer is actually really great stuff. You know, covers the gamut, particularly the field to table stuff.
Thank you. Thanks, Brad. So I guess we're kind of winding down on time. Corey's giving me weird looks, which means I need to close this out. So I will say, Brad, if you have a last thought, alibi, question, anything you want to share with us or the listeners, actually it would be both us and the listeners, feel free, shoot away.
Yeah, I would say, you know, the book is meant to be entertaining. It's meant to poke fun at myself and shed light on as many mistakes as all of the great times and phenomenal experiences that I've had in the field. Anyone who wants to get into upland bird hunting, it doesn't have to be intimidating or complicated or, you know, scary. I think that's one of the perspectives that I write from. You know, it's like you can go out there, as I did, with pretty much no experience and very little knowledge and still really enjoy and learn. And I ended up with phenomenal dogs just because we taught each other and went to the field and enjoyed our time together, you know. And so that's really what hunting and the outdoors is all about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Corey, last thought.
Thanks, Brad, for coming on, talking to us about your book, and everybody out there needs to get one.
Yes, Corey, I agree with Corey, 100%. No, thanks, Brad. I'm glad. Thank you for the book, and thanks for making the time to come on and chat about it. I think that you will find you're definitely your stories are going to inspire more people than you realize to pick up a side-by-side or over-under and get out in the field, which is good. So I thank you for that because it's awesome. And, yeah, definitely thanks for all that you do for us at Harvest in Nature, and thanks for jotting down and poking fun at yourself so that at our entertainment expense.
Absolutely.
All-around great book. Like I said, I agree with Corey. Everybody else should go out and buy it, so do that now. Pause this podcast and go. But for all those listening out there, make sure you head over to Brad's Instagram page. Brad, can you remind us what it is one more time?
Yep, it's Tailfeathers Upland, so that's Tailfeathers _ Upland. And if you're wondering, that one had to do with not only upland bird tails, but Llewellyn setter tails. Because they have that fancy, flashy tail feathering that I just love. So,
yeah, good name. Thanks for sharing that context. Then once you do that, head over to the Harvest in Nature on all the various social media platforms. And then whatever podcast platform you listen to, please punch that 5-star button. Tell us what we're doing wrong or, you know, tell us what we're doing right. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.